Let me begin.
Okay, there it is.
There we go. Okay, good. Okay, I won't move. Okay. So the October 19th, 1962 issue of Time magazine. Let me actually put this up now. I think about it. Computer, large screen. There we go. Okay. So the October 19th, 1962 issue of Time magazine ran an unsigned editorial titled "Crow Jim," admonishing a new generation of jazz musicians whom the piece described as, quote, angry young men who are passionately involved in the rise of Negro nationalism. And the article goes on to say, jazz compositions these days bear titles like A Message from Kenya by Art Blakey, Uhuru Africa by Randy Weston, Africa Speaks, America Answers by Guy Warren, Afro-American Sketches, Oliver Nelson, Max Roach's Freedom Now Suite includes tunes like Tears for Johannesburg, a lament for the African shot down in Sharpeville Massacre, end quote. Now, most of these artists were not necessarily self-identified black nationalists, nor were they all so-called American Negroes. In fact, one, Guy Warren, who's in the picture there, the drummer, and here's a picture of him there, was actually from Ghana. And in a long unpublished letter to the editor, Warren made a point to distance himself from the other musicians listed in the article. And in fact, he insisted that his album, Africa Speaks, America Answers, in no way shares the politics or aesthetic sensibilities of the artists in the article. So what's more, he takes him to task for what he calls jumping on the African bandwagon and credits himself with bringing African music to American jazz when no one was interested. And then he says, quote, the miracle happened. Africa began to stir from her deep sleep and to stretch out her strong hands. The black giant was ready to take her place in world affairs. Suddenly, Africa became the thing. It became the gimmick in the trade, he continued, and every SOB jumped on the wagon to make money. In America, that is the supreme thing, how to make money and make it fast. So Max Roach, Art Blakey, and many other musicians started to play their so-called African music and to give such aggressive titles to their music. So he describes their music as, quote, racial and prejudicial and very hollow and meaningless to me. Whatever we want to call it, in Warren's view, it is not African music. So in some respects, Warren's remarks are self-serving. A Ghanaian drummer committed to fusing jazz and African rhythms, Warren had spent the previous 7 years struggling for recognition and fighting to get his unique brand of music heard. So by 1962, he found himself competing in an overcrowded field. And yet there's no denying that Africa had become the thing. It was the age of African independence, Patrice Lumumba's assassination, the era of Bandung, and the rise of the Third World, events and movements that profoundly shaped the politics and music of the period. Now, on the other side of the Atlantic, Africa's descendants were embroiled in their own freedom struggle, from Montgomery to Memphis, Birmingham to Brooklyn. But even as U.S. struggles for racial justice and equality intensified, black activists and artists never took their eyes off of Africa. African nationalist leaders visited the U.S. and made pilgrimages to Harlem, while African Americans formed liberation support committees and looked to the continent to blaze a more hopeful future for the diaspora. Consequently, during the era of decolonization, we witnessed an explosion of jazz recordings bearing African themes. Now, while it's generally accepted that African liberation movements and a kind of nostalgic, if not romantic, conception of Africa as a lost homeland inspired musicians to compose paeans to the continent, how do we account for figures like Guy Warren or the astounding popularity of jazz in South Africa during this period, or the dynamic Lagos jazz scene that pianist Randy Weston encountered during his visits to Nigeria? Why are African jazz musicians absent from the dialogue? Indeed, was there ever a dialogue, musical or otherwise? Or was Africa merely invoked in the imaginations and of cultural nationalists and the politically conscious artists? What impact did decolonization and increased opportunities to travel between Africa and the U.S. have on the creation of new music, new fusions, or the new politics of jazz. So by exploring the work, conversations, collaborations, and tensions between both African and African-American musicians during the era of decolonization, I'm trying to write this book, which is called Africa Speaks, America Answers, that explains how modern Africa figured in reshaping jazz during the 50s and 60s, early 60s mainly, how modern jazz figured in the formation of a modern African identity, and how various musical convergences and crossings shape the political and cultural landscape on both continents. I'm not writing a book about how American jazz musicians supported African liberation or imagined Africa. That's actually been done before. Rather, I'm really interested in transnational encounters between musicians and between artists in place, how encounters with specific places, people, movements, cultures provide fertile ground for new music and new musical practices. Specifically, I look at five artists and the groups they led during this era of decolonization. Besides Guy Warren, I'm writing about Randy Weston, bassist Ahmed Abdul Malik, and a couple of South African musicians. There's Kippie Moketsi in the Jazz Epistles on your left there. That's Kippie playing the saxophone. And then a vocalist, Satsuma B. Benjamin, who's also South African. Now, each of these artists was propelled by the upheavals of the 1950s to seek new musical forms, new collaborations, new fusions across time and space. They shared neither a common agenda nor a common culture, though they all recognized and often embraced cultural commonalities, jazz being one of them. And of course, they didn't always succeed in their experiments. On the contrary, they sometimes clashed with fellow artists, they bumped up against prevailing assumptions, the intransigence of the market, an oppressive state that viewed their music as a threat to order, or consumers whose own stereotypes made them incapable of hearing and appreciating the work. And yet, they all shared a common vision of jazz as a path to the future, a vehicle for both Africans and African Americans to articulate and realize their own distinctive modernity while critiquing its Western variant. And from their vantage point, standing at what appeared to be the precipice of freedom for Africa and Black America, the continent represented a beacon of modernity, not an ancient past, but a beacon of modernity, blazing a new path for the rest of the world, but one tempered by deeply spiritual anti-materialist values. So this sort of kind of Janus-faced modernism is a key, I think, to understanding the nexus of jazz and Africa in the age of decolonization. So one of the book's central tenets is that we need to think about modernity not as a moment or a period in history or a universally shared process, but as much a local as a global conception created always in relation to other nations, cultures, and movements. While some of the artists in the book might have approached, you know, African musics and African cultures as a window onto the past, a reclaiming of ancient identity, spirituality, and cultural practices, I argue that it was that very window that enabled these artists to hear new sounds, create new modes of music making, and envision a different future. It should come as no surprise, then, that many of the musicians and composers that I include here, Africans and African Americans, mined Africa as well as Asia and the Middle East for sources of new ideas for experimental music. They were modernists in search of radically different elements in harmony, the use of modal music, rhythm and timbre, and African music, not just, you know, West African, North African, South, but also East African music, offered richer possibilities for freeing the music from the prevailing harmonic and rhythmic constrictions of swing and bebop. But there were also limits. Artists constantly bumped up against the sort of rigid walls of authenticity. Critics, fans, record producers, even the musicians policed the boundaries between what they believed was real African music, read traditional, and real jazz. Self-proclaimed experts alike questioned whether African Americans were capable of mastering traditional drumming techniques, or if Africans could swing or play authentic jazz. Arab music aficionados expressed skepticism toward jazz musicians attempting to play an Arab scale or maqam correctly. The hybrid and global character of the music generated many questions about its authenticity. So ironically, the very conditions that made these fusions possible and commercially viable, including a small but significant commercial boom in all things Africans during this period, also constrained innovation and experimentation. I'm not suggesting that these particular artists were in heavy demand, but rather their work appeared amid a flurry of recordings and performances of African music and dance and other quote-unquote exotic commodities. In fact, I call this period the African invasion because it parallels the British invasion in terms of the influence of Africa on U.S. popular culture. So what I want to do with the limited time I have, now that I kind of gave you an overview of this project, is I want to give you like little capsule summaries of some of the arguments and interventions I'm making about for these artists, and then really stretch out on one, and that is Guy Warren, who I'm totally obsessed with, I have to say. He's a very interesting character. So I just want to give you a little story about each one. Let's begin with Randy Weston. So I have this chapter called Uhuru Africa, The Sojourns of Randy Weston. And that story follows the musical, political, and spiritual journey of the pianist-composer whose name is really synonymous with bridging jazz and Africa. In fact, his fascination with Africa begins in childhood, having been reared by parents who were dedicated followers of Marcus Garvey in Brooklyn, particularly in the neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant. And in fact, if you were walking around Bedford-Stuyvesant in the 1940s and 50s, you would think it was like an African village, because it had a really rich Pan-African culture. And in fact, I love this picture. This is a restaurant called the African Quarter, which was in Bedford-Stuyvesant, opened in 1958. It was the first African restaurant there, you know, right across from a park where you always had drummers from all over Brooklyn playing on Sunday. It's like sort of like Brooklyn's Congo Square. Weston fell in love with Africa from afar, rejecting the derogatory representations of the so-called dark continent, and welcoming African artists in exile he encountered in America. He set out on a personal quest to know the continent's history and to counter the prevailing racist and colonialist stereotypes. And in fact, he made history in 1960, and this is the 50th anniversary of the recording Uhuru Africa, which he made in 1960, which was a four-part suite dedicated to the independent African nations. It was arranged by Melba Liston, great trombonist and arranger. The poetry, or the libretto, lyrics were by Langston Hughes, and it was performed by a big band made up of musicians from West and East Africa, Cuba, and the U.S. You know, it was truly a diasporic statement that both acknowledged Africa's ancient roots and charted a new path for modern music. And a year later, he finally set foot on African soil, expecting to find the pristine, traditional world he'd heard so much about. But instead, he goes to Lagos, and Lagos is a bustling, modern city. And there he finds African musicians deeply immersed in either modern jazz, and this is a picture Zio on it, or a fusion of like high life music. And what happens is that he's poised to find traditional music. He returns to America with high life music, a popular dance music indebted to the Caribbean, the colonial military bands, the church hymns, a whole range of things. Weston's various sojourns deepen his understanding of African culture, enriched his work as a composer, and sharpened his political commitment to liberatory politics, both to the U.S. and abroad. And so what I want to do is just give you a little taste of that particular album. He has a song on here called Congolese Children, which is a Bashai folk song that he heard that he kind of put to high life rhythms. So let's just hear a little piece of that. Turn his piano into like a kalimba or African thumb piano, you know. I also shift sites away from the West African US nexus to North Africa and the Middle East in the Black Islamic imaginary to tell a story of bassist oud player Ahmad Abdul Malik, who was actually, he's in the middle there, who was actually a friend of Randy West. They grew up together in Brooklyn. They collaborated a little bit. In fact, Ahmad Abdul Malik was Weston's bass player for a while. So he converted to Ahmadiyya. He was a converted Ahmadiyya Muslim who claimed Sudanese ancestry. And he was very unique in that he tried to fuse the musics of Egypt, Sudan, Lebanon, Syria, in other parts of the Muslim world with jazz to create new music that's both deeply spiritual and ancient and experimental and modern. And I should say that though he claims Sudanese ancestry, I discovered in doing deep research that his family's from St. Vincent in the Caribbean. But he kind of remade himself. He was born Jonathan Tim. And in fact, I argue that his recordings from the late 50s or early 60s were precursors to both free jazz and modal music, but they have been overlooked because the sacred nature of the music he played rendered it outside the narrative of modern music. So if it's sacred music, it can't be modern. I also examined the context of Abdul Malik's music. On the one hand, we witness a political fascination with North Africa and the Middle East spurred by the Suez Canal crisis, the rise of Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser. On the other hand, the US experience of national obsession with the music of the Middle East marketed and sold in the West as exotic, hypersexual, if not pornographic. This is like the whole hoochie coochie belly dancing music that sold like wildfire in the 50s. Abdul Malik's experiments were in many ways a foil against the Middle Eastern craze and a celebration of the dignity and power of Islam represented for the Black world. So I'm just going to hear a little piece of something else by Abdul Malik, and this is called it's probably his most non-Islamic piece, but it's pretty interesting. It's called Nights on Saturn. Let's see if I could find it here. And I love this piece because, if I could find it. Oh, hold on 1 second. Okay, here we go. I like it because you're gonna hear a reed instrument. I was just talking about this to a graduate student the other day, called a peri, and it's a Korean instrument that Ahmad Abdul Rahman, Bilal Abdul Rahman, who's on your far right there, he picked up this instrument during the Korean War, as a soldier, when he befriended a number of Korean farmers. And this guy gave him this instrument, this peri. And so it's like double reed, and it's a beautiful instrument. So he basically plays it with the band. I'm not going to say much more, but just listen to what's going on here. So the book's final two chapters focus on South Africa. The first in the life of alto saxophonist Skippy Moketsi and a group of incredibly talented musicians, notably Hugh Masekela, Abdullah Ibrahim, who went by Dollar Brand, Jonas Gwangwa, who formed the short-lived Jazz Epistles. And this is not a story of transatlantic travel or intercultural collaboration. Rather, it is a story of what happens when the preservation of tradition, or the authentic, is used by state power as a means to repress and control the population, apartheid. In South Africa during the first decade of official apartheid, when the center of black arts and entertainment in Transvaal, Sophiatown, was being razed, and urban popular culture is under siege, many black artists and intellectuals turned to modern jazz in certain forms of township music as a way forward, as a challenge against the retrograde native policies of the new regime. And Moketsi and the Jazz Epistles, however, were less inclined to play anything besides their own compositions and jazz standards in an innovative post-bop style. So they performed popular township music when it was financially incumbent, but they stood as paragons of modernity against a racist state that rendered the so-called kafir pre-modern and dismissed the kind of music they played as, quote, too complex for the Bantu mind. So the group made only one LP called Jazz Epistles Verse 1. And it was an amazing album, by the way, recorded in 2 hours. If you know anything about going to a recording studio, they recorded the whole album in 2 hours, all original pieces. They knew the music very well because they'd been playing together for that whole year and a half. It received limited circulation in South Africa and was really unheard outside the country at first. I mean, it took many, many years before it kind of made global circulation. And as I argue, their invisibility as a band reveals that globalization of an art form does not guarantee transnational encounters, exchanges, and collaborations. It also exposes the problem of jazz history's persistent Americocentrism. So soon after the recording, the Jazz Epistles fell apart, prompted in part by members going into exile after the Sharpeville massacre. I mean, they made this recording just months before Sharpeville. And ironically, I should say weeks before Sharpeville, to be honest, ironically, in exile, many of these same sort of so-called purists began fusing indigenous South African music, rural music, township music, with jazz, creating a music that was deemed, in this context, highly political and oppositional. It also proved commercially viable, as Hugh Masekela, Jonas Gwangwa, Abdullah Ibrahim all enjoyed successful careers outside of South Africa. Moketsi, who's the elder of the group and one of its leaders, remained in the country, never achieving the recognition his bandmates thought he deserved. So finally, I just want to play the Jazz Epistles, verse 1, the song called Scullery Department, which was a composition by Kippy. And there's a lot going on here. I won't go into it, but for musicians who think about time, you know, how time is marked, just listen really carefully. And again, part of my argument is that here's one of the most astounding bands in 1959-60 that just does not exist on the radar. That's all I get to hear. But I'm telling you, if you can get that, if you can get that record, it's actually been re-released on a CD compilation called Jazz in Africa, Volume 1. So finally, vocalist Satima B. Benjamin, who I just found out there's a film that just came out this year about her life, which is just stunning. She provides the book's coda. And although she occasionally sat in with the Jazz Epistles with this band, and she married the group's pianist, Abdullah Ibrahim, her career really didn't take off until she and her husband fled the country. Her story takes us to the end of apartheid and represents the problem of the modern African in exile, unable to return. Benjamin is one of the greatest living jazz singers with perhaps the deepest commitment to Africa and to the jazz world, and yet has yet to experience the kind of success, recognition, and she also has a deep sense of alienation from both the jazz world and, in some ways, from certain African politics. Why is that? Well, like Guy Warren, who we're going to talk about, Satima B. Benjamin wasn't African enough for the market, or Western enough, read American, to earn a place in the pantheon of great jazz vocalists, Sarah Vaughan, Betty Carter, Ella Fitzgerald, Abby Lincoln, to name a few. As a quote-unquote colored who grew up in Cape Town, though she was born in Johannesburg, she was not considered authentically African, like, say, Mary Makeba or Leta Mbulu. And despite decades living and working in New York City, she was rarely given her due as an authentic jazz singer. And as a woman, Benjamin had to live in the shadow of her more famous husband, Abdullah Ibrahim, and she made certain decisions that privileged his career over hers. Finally, throughout the 1970s and 80s, her energies went into supporting the African National Congress, which included writing political anthems that likely contributed to her marginalization. The irony, of course, is that at the very moment when the demand for neo-African jazz has really reached its height, Along comes an extraordinarily talented and gifted singer committed to preserving the idiom of jazz and transforming it with the rhythms of her homeland. And yet, she's largely ignored. Thus, as the walls of apartheid came tumbling down in the jazz world, Africa spoke, but few answered. This is just an excerpt from Satema's song, from the Africa Liberation Suite, from her record, Memories and Dreams. I'm just going to hear the beginning of it. You got to get that record because you don't have time to hear the whole thing. So, sorry, time is short. But remember, don't ever forget that we started late. So, now for the man at hand. You should read that as you think about that. Just read those two quotes. I'll give you a second. Guy Warren Akwe. I know it's kind of interesting, but you'll see. How this relates. Guy Warren Akwe was born in Accra on May 4th, 1923, to Susanna Awula Abla Moore, an unmarried teenage mother, and Richard Mabuo Akwe, a respected educator and headmaster of the Ghana National School. His father named him Warren after U.S. President Warren Harding. But besides naming him and financing his education, Richard Akwe barely acknowledged his son. Warren attended the government elementary school, boys' school rather, in Accra. He led the school band in his last 2 years, while also performing as an actor in various local productions. His formative music education, however, came from a neighborhood bar that catered to American seamen and played jazz. That's how he grew to love the music. At 15, he earned a spot as a drummer in the Accra Rhythmic Orchestra, a popular dance band known mainly for high life music, though the repertoire also included jazz. Warren's musical and dramatic talents earned him a scholarship to the Gold Coast's prestigious Achimota College. He enrolled in the teacher training program there in 1941, but 2 years later, with the war raging and with American GIs all over the Gold Coast, Warren actually took a job with the OSS. Okay? And allowed him to travel to Latin America and to the U.S., where he spent a few months in New York in 1943, living in the village, actually, occasionally sitting in at a club called Nick's Tavern in the village. And it was a club known really for Chicago-style jazz and Dixieland. After Warren returned to Accra, he wrote for the Daily Spectator newspaper and took a gig as a DJ for the Gold Coast Radio Broadcasting Service and became the drummer for the Tempos in 1947, which is a wildly popular band led by the great E.T. Mensah and Joe Kelly, a high life band. In 1950, he leaves Ghana and he goes to England, plays with Kenny Graham, the Afro-Cubist ensemble for about a year, then returns armed with Cuban percussion instruments, with bongos, conga drums, and a deeper knowledge of jazz, calypso, rumba, and other diasporic music. Struck by the similarities between West African high life and Trinidadian calypso, Warren formed his own Afro-Cubist ensemble and traveled throughout the region, eventually settling into Monrovia, Liberia, where he became the assistant director and DJ for Liberia's Eternal Love Broadcasting Corporation. For Warren, his stint at ELBC was like earning a postgraduate degree in music. Besides introducing jazz and Caribbean music to West African listeners, Warren recalled fondly, quote, "I played classical music for listeners, Rimsky-Korsakov, Berlin, Stravinsky, Mozart, you name it, Handel, Chopin, all of them. I did that for 2 years or 3 years. I read their notes and played their music and got to know it." He also got to know an attractive African-American nurse named Justina Alexander. And so they fall in love. She convinces him to come with her to Chicago, where he wants to go anyway, with the intention of getting married. And that's complicated because after he's there a few months, it turns out that one of his neighbors, turns out she's pregnant with his child. So Justina Alexander didn't get married to Guy Warren. But he gets to Chicago, which is the point. And he does move there around January 1955. He starts working with trumpet player Vibus Gene Esposito and his Latin jazz Latin orchestra, jazz Latin group. And he, in fact, Guy Warren becomes the first and only black member of the band, which is comprised entirely of Italian and Jewish musicians. So through Esposito's band and a Chicago drummer, an African-American Chicago drummer named Red Saunders, Warren is able to record his first album within a year of his arrival. And it's called Africa Speaks, America Answers. And it was an amazing album for many reasons. As the first jazz African music fusion album, the band happened to be all white, okay, except for Warren and Saunders. Band members included names like Tony Napolnelli, Johnny LaMonica, in fact, you could look at the picture of the recording session, Johnny Frigo, Jerry Friedman. And what's so ironic about this, because if you remember how we began our story, we began with the Time Magazine article called Crow Jim that accused Guy Warren as being one of those who practices reverse racism. I mean, he makes the only African jazz fusion album, you know, of the moment, and it's basically a Italian and Jewish band, and he's accused of Crow Jim. Second, it was made up entirely of original compositions by Warren that did more than fuse traditional African music and jazz. It also drew on popular dance rhythms like High Life, on classical music, and it really defied any inherited categories. And like the music of Randy West and Ahmed Abdul-Malik, it had a very strong sacred dimension. In particular, songs such as Africa Speaks, Ode to a Stream, Ayiwala Dong, which is My Thanks to God, Chant, Invocation of the Horned Viper, are either based on traditional sacred music or convey spiritual and religious themes. Musicians who were initially drawn to Warren found the sacred elements in his music especially attractive, and the fact that he was a real African, like a real African from the continent, only enhanced his spiritual cachet. And yet, Warren, who to me is such a fascinating figure, he didn't practice any West African religion. He wasn't into, you know, Orishas. He wasn't a Muslim. He wasn't a Christian. And despite the fact that he used Islamic and Christian themes in his music, Warren was a practicing Buddhist. So you have this Ghanaian Buddhist, 1955, in Chicago, okay? So if you listen to a song like Chant, for example, it's a narrative piece set in a West African village. And the story is that the chief is dead, and the royal drummer, who is Warren, uses the bintinobonu, the talking drum, to convey the message to everyone and to assemble the warriors for customary funeral rites. And so after they gather, Warren plays the drum again to perform the drum ritual, which accompanies the dead body, and halfway through, joined by the saxophone and piano. So what the royal drummer is saying here is he's saying, "Hear ye, hear ye, And the musicians and warriors who are speaking in Ga are saying, "We hear." And again, these are Chicago Jews and Italians speaking in Ga. You got to remember that. And the drummer then says, "We have, as one man with one voice, done our duty to the chief." And then the warriors answer, "We have." And the drummer says, "Peace to the chief." Okay. So this is chant. Just going to hear the beginning of it here.
Mpehinifo muntie. Oduman se machile ma. Obrimponse. Bra, mprim. Ago, atame.
Amen.
Ago, atame.
Amen.
Twa, omanyaba.
Ya.
Twa, omanyaba.
Ya.
Jeo gbenkomie.
Ya.
Twa, omanyaba.
Ya.
O say, yay.
Hey, yay.
O say, hey, yay.
Hey, yay. Hey, my four. Hey, my four. Say, who? Say, who? Marco Janso.
Nay. A bobby boat, a tabby boat.
Nay. A bobby boat, a tabby boat. Hey, nay.
Jacob.
Hey.
Jeriba.
Hey, nebe. Abwa biribo.
Teta biribo.
Hey!
So most of the pieces, however, are not like this. In fact, they break with tradition and are intended to be thoroughly modern fusions of jazz and West African music. And a great example is a song he calls Jazz As I See It. And it begins with Red Saunders playing the classic swing rhythm using the sock cymbal. And then the piano comes in playing these dotted 16th note figures, and Warren sings and is playing congas. And the hand clappings on the one with a bass pedal point in D, it's like a drone. So without giving a whole lot of technical stuff, check out this swinging version of Jazz As I See It. This is his vision played out. So his ambition, though, went way beyond jazz, African fusion. He actually wanted to merge classical music with jazz to create a new art music. And he included songs like My Minuet, which is a very traditional waltz. It's like Bach with African rhythms underneath it. And the most interesting piece is a song called Ode to a Stream, where the music tells the story of a journey of a stream. And it's a beautiful violin solo by Johnny Frigo. And here's Guy Warren plucking piano strings to produce a melodic line, which is then repeated by Gene Esposito on vibes. And then, of course, a watery effect is created with brushes on the cymbal. And so this is Ode to a Stream. And you could hear his little poem as well.
A silent, restless nomad, up and down the land, gentle and beautiful. Who cares what you are? We do, my heart and I.
By the way, that kind of offbeat clicking sound is called vinyl. I know a lot of you never heard of that, but back in the day, they used to have these big things. And I apologize for that, but you know, some of this music has not been released on CD, by the way. It's still in vinyl, and you know, if you want to try to find copies, you usually have to send off to Japan and pay a lot of money, which is, you know, why I do all these gigs to pay for this music. Now, the last thing I want to play for you before you sort of get to the last part of his story is on this album, he also introduces high life music. In fact, I don't think he's wrong when he makes the claim that he's the first one to introduce high life to an American audience on an American jazz label. And I just want to play for you Monkeys and Butterflies, because not only is it really an amazing song for what it anticipates, but if you know Fela's, you know, aesthetic, a lot of those elements are there in this particular recording, including the female vocalists who actually happen to be the wives of the musicians. And that's probably pretty interesting as well. Okay, so this is Monkeys and Butterflies. So he makes his album, and he spends 2 years in Chicago, then he decides to try his fortunes in New York City. He gets a job at a place called the African Room on 7th Avenue, where African music, calypso, and Afro-Cuban music is featured. And as you can see, the fact that such a venue existed, and there were two, in fact, in New York, one on 3rd Avenue, was further indication of the growing popularity of African and African-based music like calypso, but it also meant the music was highly commercialized and marketed in a manner that played on stereotypes. So the first night he comes out, and he's dressed in his blue kente robe, his blue velvet kofi, and the owner of the club, Harold Cantor, has a fit. And he says, look, that's not acceptable. You need to change into our regular outfit. The regular outfit consists of torn off half-sleeve collarless white shirt, raggedy black pants, rolled halfway up the legs, and a tattered and torn straw hat, and no shoes. Because this is the style. It's supposed to represent the kind of Caribbean, but Warren refused, Cantor eventually relented, and it was a real struggle on his part to basically put forward what he felt like was the dignity of African culture. And at the African Room, Warren met many of the leading percussionists of the day, Latino, African American, and among them was James, James Hawthorne Bay, or what we know as Chief Bay. And Bay grew up in New York City across the street from Abyssinian Baptist Church. He was taught drums by a woman named Ismay Andrews from Philadelphia, who taught African dance classes at Abyssinian. And Bay also studied with Moses Mians, who had been playing with Catherine Dunham and Pearl Primus. He was from Nigeria. And so when he met Warren, you know, Chief Bay was already an accomplished drummer. Impressed with Bay, Warren hired him for his next album, recorded in 1958, called Guy Warren Sounds, Themes for African Drums. And, you know, what's interesting about this picture, if you've really been paying attention, is that that is not Guy Warren in the picture. They used the model because they didn't think Guy Warren looked African enough, okay? And this is RCA Victor. And a particularly fascinating piece is called The Talking Drum Looks Ahead, where he tries to fulfill his dream of introducing the talking drum, Bintin Obonu, as a tonal instrument, or another tonal instrument, and he plays a melodic line on the drum over blues changes. And so check this out. By the way, Thelonious Monk picked up this melody and wrote a song. I'm going to skip over one part, so let me just jump over this one section, and let me just talk about, finally, Themes for African Drums. Unfortunately, got very few reviews, despite Warren's enthusiastic promotion of it. And the silence surrounding it really seems odd, because by this time, it's like 1958, 59, drum music had really taken off at the time. I mean, Art Blakey, for example, recorded the drum suite and Orgy and Rhythm in 1957, though he used all mainly Cuban and Puerto Rican percussionists. And, you know, so that was huge. And then the really big event in 1960 was this, the recording of Olatunji's Drums of Passion. And Michael Babatunde Olatunji's Drums of Passion was recorded by Columbia Records, which was the big label, and recorded in the summer, in fall of 1959, released in 1960. Now, why is Olatunji important? He is credited often as the first musician to create authentic African drum music in the US. But as far as Warren was concerned, Olatunji was more of a hustler than the African-American musicians who played faux African music, as far as he was concerned. And throughout his memoir, published in 1962, Warren referred to Olatunji as, quote, a traitor to Africa and a complete fraud. And he told one interviewer, quote, people think that just because you come from Africa, you can play drums, that whatever you play is right. No siree. I mean, just because you come from America, it doesn't mean to say that you can play baseball. So Olatunji originally came to the U.S. in 1950 to attend Morehouse College. And in 1954, he went on to graduate school at NYU to pursue a PhD in public administration. He had no intention of becoming a musician. In fact, he was interested in politics.
He was an activist.
Having served as president of the All Africa Students Union of the Americas. In Atlanta, he did form a cultural group, however, to teach African Americans about Africa, and he played drums, though he never formally studied the instrument. In 1957, Ralph Hunter, Radio City Music Hall, the choral director, heard Olatunji and promptly hired him to be a featured soloist with the Music Hall Symphony Orchestra for a piece titled African Drum Fantasy. Voice of America recorded it and broadcast it overseas. Suddenly, Olatunji was in big demand. He did radio, performed all over the country at the Apollo, Carnegie Hall, even the Jack Parr Show. This is like overnight. And when Olatunji recorded Drums of Passion, he was already a star, right? A rising star. What's interesting about the recording is that he hired three key African-American drummers with whom he'd been working. Chief Bey is one, Montego Joe, who passed away recently, and Taiwo Duval. And by some accounts, these three drummers, who many of whom trained with Moses Mianz, the Nigerian drummer, were the main anchor for the music and for what gets billed as the first authentic African drum record. So of course, the first authentic African drum record by Olatunji, the main anchor are all African-American drummers, or Afro-Caribbean. Of course, the record goes on to sell 5 million copies, and the sad story is that Olatunji got very little of that money. But that's another story. The sudden explosion of Olatunji was a source of frustration for Warren, especially since he was desperately trying to sell his third album, which he was then calling Voice of Africa. He had recorded it on his own sometime in 1959. He had finally gotten John Hammond, the great producer, interested in it at Columbia Records, so he thought. He sent him the dub and waited patiently to hear back from John Hammond's. In fact, he actually went back to Ghana. So he's waiting. He finally gets a cable from Hammond saying, and I quote, "Cannot contemplate recording you now, have inherited Olatunji," letter follows. So you know he was devastated. Desperate, Warren wrote nearly a dozen record labels trying to sell his latest recording. He struck out at Savoy, Prestige, Capitol, RCA, Atlantic, Riverside, all of them. Only Decca accepted it and released it in 1962 under the title African Rhythms, the exciting sounds of Guy Warren and his talking drum. And the record was practically a one-man show with Richard Davis, Ollie Shearer, Vibes. I mean, it was basically Warren playing everything. And it was pretty clear from the responses that the album just wasn't African enough. Despite all the singing and chanting and twee and ga, his 60-minute drum suite called The Third Phase was seen as pretentious, especially since the opening of the suite's main theme was based on Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And the kind of fusion he was trying to achieve just wasn't exciting enough as far as the industry people are concerned. This is what they're writing back to him in their letters. So as Guy Warren slowly fades off the scene, it seemed like everyone was recording with African drummers or composing themes based on African music, and some were hits. Cannonball Adderley produced the best top 40 record with African Waltz, recorded in 1961, and he had Olatunji in the band and Ray Barreto. Art Blakey's 1962 album, The African Beat, used only African and African-American drummers, and it did pretty well. Herbie Mann was selling lots of records, hiring Olatunji, and Chief Bey was getting a lot of work. And what's interesting about Chief Bey is that by this time, by 1962 or so, he is identified as Senegalese. This is the guy who grew up across the street from the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. And he's not denying it. He's like, yeah, I'm Senegalese, you know? So you got Guy Warren's not really African enough. Chief Bey is Senegalese, okay? So in the end, it seems clear that just in conclusion, this is my picture of Guy Warren, who we know now, he passed away a couple of years ago, but we know him as Kofi Ganaba. But in the end, it seems clear that Warren or Kofi Ganaba was one of the main figures behind the African musical renaissance of the late 50s and early 60s. But he wasn't African enough to be marketable. He spoke with a slight American accent. He dressed mostly like a hipster, always donned a hat and sunglasses. He didn't have an African name at that time, and he was difficult to deal with. Okay?
And we could talk about that in discussion. Very difficult person.
His main problem, though, was musical. He was too experimental in a world where African rhythms were associated with wild excitement, hip gyrations, and raw sexuality. He created a fusion that was more than blues riffs over African rhythms, but one in which rhythm, harmony, melody, and instrumentation change as a result of synthesis. He wanted to play the talking drum like a horn, and the drum set like an ngoma, bata, bell, and conga put together. And he eventually did. If you ever watched the film Sankofa, he is Sankofa. And he opens up playing the drums and he has the white powder on. But he did this. In the early 70s, he had a modified drum set replacing Western instruments with carved wooden drums of the Akan people of Ghana. On the other hand, Guy Warren was too African and too black to be taken seriously by those who claim the mantle of serious music. And this is something that I'm not addressing here, but we got to think about this. To demonstrate my point, let me just close with a little coda. In a New York Times article from November 1st, 1959, titled Shifting Tides in African Music, critic Robert Shelton quotes a prominent musicologist bemoaning the loss of traditional tribal music in favor of, quote, diluted popular music modeled after American jazz, jive, and rock and roll. And yet Shelton goes on to praise the fusion experiments of white composers. He spoke of Mieczysław Kolinsky's Dahomey Suite for Oboe and Piano, which in Kolinsky's words is his attempt to, quote, blend the non-harmonic structure of West African Negro songs. Just reflect on that for a second. The non-harmonic structure of West African Negro songs with the harmonic, polyphonic language of contemporary Western music. And he was especially impressed with Fred Katz, who had just released an album called Folk Songs for Far Out Folk on Warner Brothers, which included three African-derived numbers. Katz wrote in the liner notes, quote, I think it is time for jazz players and composers to extend their horizons toward other cultures rather than to Tin Pan Alley tune pickers. I know this album is a humble beginning, but it is a beginning. As if nothing else came before him, as if Guy Warren doesn't exist. So when it's all said and done, all of the people involved in this story, Guy Warren, Art Blakey, Chief Bey, Montego Joe, Tywo Duvall, not to mention people I didn't mention, like Asadada Defora, Moses Mianz, all of them were essentially invisible men. And in the Ellisonian sense, perhaps the kind of drum wars that in some ways defeated Guy Warren were yet another battle royale. Thank you.